Hi, I'm Richard. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be clean and sober, and at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I'd like to thank Glenn and Daryl for having me speak. It's an honor and a privilege. You know, there's no leaders or anything here, but there are honors. And it was an honor to be able to give a cake to four of my favorite people, including one of my sponsees, who now has what in the big book is called significant sobriety. Now, a lot of us think that significant sobriety is what, like 15, 20, 30 years? But in 1937, Bill wrote that there were 24 of us now with significant sobriety, and that was 2.5 years. But they were doing something more than just being a member of a fellowship. They were part of recovery. I didn't start drinking until I was 6 years old. I waited as long as I possibly could, but the pressures of childhood were just effing overwhelming. So I did what any good alcoholic would do. I was at a function with the family, and all the kids were given a couple ounces of wine to toast along with the adults, and I took mine, and it was like, yeah, and I glug, glug, and it was gone. All the other kids took theirs and put their tongue in. I was like, yeah, I don't like it. It burns. So, go figure. So I drank all of theirs. And, you know, Bobby, thank you. Bobby told me that the first meeting that she went to where there was a speaker, I was the speaker, and she said, there are other people who drink and use like me. And I was that guy. I was a shy little kid. When I was told to go out and play with the other kids, what that meant to me was to go hide in the bushes and watch the other kids play. And I started drinking that night, and I'll tell you, I changed to a cross between Einstein and Superman, at least in my head. Nobody else saw it. By the end of the evening, I was, let's get down and party. I knew what it meant to party. You know, I was a party monster at age 6, and I was starting fights and being funny and threw up on myself and passed out on my grandmother's stairs. And when I came to the next morning, I realized I didn't drink like other 6-year-olds. And that was the most important discovery of my childhood, because it talks in the big book about our alcoholic career. It's not a hobby or a part-time job or something we do when it's convenient. It's a career. And I knew what my career was going to be at age 6. I didn't have to go to some elementary school vocational counselor or something like that. I wanted to be an alcoholic, and I pursued it. So by the time I got into high school, drugs had entered into the program. I know this is an AA meeting, and I like to be respectful, but we got to remember that when Bill and Bob were drinking, alcohol was an illegal drug back in Prohibition times. But none, and there are drugs in the big book. They all took them. We wouldn't have wanted them to miss anything. So I basically did every drug there is, and if I didn't like it, I only did it a few times. And if I did like it, I did it regularly. But I always chose drugs that weren't addicting, which is why I was able to smoke pot every day for 35 years, because it wasn't addicting. You know, and I did cocaine twice, once for 25 years, a few minutes of sleep in there somewhere, I think. I'm not really certain. I was a record producer and did real well at it, made over 400 major albums, sold probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 million albums. That part of my life was the only thing that was going good. And I always thought that what really my main thing that I could do in life was I could get loaded and not go to sleep or fall down. And that qualified me to sit in front of the recording album console and make record albums. And basically, it was the kind of job where being loaded really seemed to work to my advantage, because we wouldn't start working until the drugs and alcohol arrived, unless there was a refrigerator full of long neck buds and a freezer full of Stoli or Absolute, and you know, a big plate of white powder, a powder greater than ourselves. We weren't about to start work. So, I mean, we'd sit there with our arms folded, like, well, you don't expect us to work, do you? And things were, on that level, things were really good. But I'm a first-step alcoholic. I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol, and my wife had become unmanageable. So I sent her to rehab. That's a guy to do. And I figured that while she was in rehab that I would quit on my own, because I'm one of those self-motivated, strong-willed kind of people who can do things when I decide to do them. Well, there it was. A week had gone by, and I was still getting loaded every day. I couldn't stop. It was like trying to stop a freight train with my tennis shoes. And there was a lot of smoke and screaming, but no slowing down. And finally, it was about a week before she was supposed to get out of rehab, and I knew there was going to be big trouble. And I come from a family where there are no other alcoholics. I check everybody for three generations in every direction, and which really was good for me, because I got to clean out all their medicine cabinets and all their liquor cabinets before they even knew what had hit them. But my wife's family, they're in the dictionary. You look up alcoholic or dysfunctional, and there's their picture in the margin. And her brother, who I had come to think of as an alcoholic of our variety, you know, not some guy who had a couple of wine coolers and stubbed his toe and decided he better get into recovery, but somebody who was an all-day, everyday alcoholic, was starting to show up everywhere clean and sober. And at first, I wondered why anybody would do such a thing, because I didn't trust anybody who wasn't loaded. And secondly, I started to wonder, how did he do such a thing? So I called him. I was about 8 or 9 days before she was supposed to get out of rehab, and I said, he was up in Washington State. And I said, Robert, I'm having trouble. I just can't stop getting loaded. I'm drinking by 11 o'clock in the morning, and then I'm doing drugs, and I'm going to sleep loaded, and I just don't know what to do. He says, I'll tell you what to do. He says, go to the phone book. I don't care where you are in the world. And at the beginning of the phone book, you're going to find AA. I said, AA? Ugh, isn't that Alcoholics Anonymous? He says, yeah, why? I says, well, why would I want to go get drunk with people I don't even know? He says, well, what do you mean? I said, well, I understand English. Alcoholics drink. And if I'm not mistaken, anonymous means you don't know each other. So I figured it was like the opposite of Cheers, where everyone knows your name. This was a private bar where it was dark and smoky and nobody had to know who you were. And he says, oh, I think you're going to find it to be a little different, but let's not argue about it. And I called AA Central Office, which was a real thrill, because you could see them smiling over the phone. We've got one! And they sent me to a meeting. And I thought I was going to get loaded with people I didn't know. And rather than buy all the drinks there, I had like 4 or 5 drinks before I left the house, which was necessary to drive properly anyway. And, rolled up a few spliefs and a gram of white powder, and I was on my way to the meeting to, you know, see how people stop drinking. Well, I got there fashionably late, which I did to everything, and the meeting was already going, but they were just starting to ask, are there any newcomers? And I just hid, so I wasn't about to announce myself as a newcomer. And something really mad, and I also, I noticed that nobody else seemed to be quite as loaded as I was. And I thought, boy, these people really hold their liquor well. You know, this is a fine bunch. I might learn something from them. Yeah, I'll bet they can even drive home. But something magic happened at that meeting. We talk a lot in these rooms about magic and opinions and principles and stuff like that, and miracles. I got a parking space right in front. And most people say, that was a miracle. That's not a miracle. The person who was parked there before me pulled out. I pulled in. I had a parking space. But I went to this meeting, and people were sharing. They were laughing at stuff that to me was, like, dreadfully personal. Like Bobby said, I don't want to say things. There might be a policeman waiting at the end. And I thought, how dare they, share about stuff like this? And I laughed from my gut. I had not laughed in years. The only funny stuff at that point were movies like Airplane or The Three Stooges. And, real personal stuff was very deadly serious. And I laughed from my soul. And I went home after that meeting, and I didn't get loaded. Now, that's the miracle. The next day, I had 24 hours clean and sober for the first time in 35 years. And I thought, I wonder if they have meetings in Malibu on Saturdays. I hadn't seen a meeting directory yet where there's 2,500 meetings a week. And I got some smiling guy at Central Office. He said, why, yes, there is. And you never imagine where he sent me, right here. And I came, and I got a lot more out of it because I wasn't loaded. And I began to get what was going on here. And I thought, this might just work out for me. And then I went to the Sunday meeting. I had 48 hours. The next day I had 72 hours. It was starting to turn into a week. My wife was getting out of rehab. Things were great. Life doesn't get any better. And I went to a late night meeting at the Michael Landon Center, which they used to have on Friday nights. But the week I went, I think, was the final demise of that meeting. The secretary didn't show up. The room was locked. Everybody had gotten home because, of course, I got there fashionably late. And there were two guys sitting on a park bench in front of the Michael Landon Center arguing. And I got out of my car and I come walking up and they said, are you here for the meeting? I thought, geez, am I that obvious? And they said, yes, you are. And they said, you might as well stick around. I said, there's only two of you. And they said, well, anywhere there's more than two people gathered for the purpose of recovery, can be an AA meeting. And I thought, what the heck, I don't have anything else to do. And they were arguing. The one guy was saying, this is a fatal progressive illness. And unless you do the recovery part of the program, you're probably going to die of this disease. And it's not just the fellowship, which I thought, had been really nice up to that point. And there's stuff that you've got to do. And the other guy was saying, no. Take what you want and leave the rest. There's no musts in the program. We'll tailor a program to fit your needs. One day at a time, easy does it, blah, blah, blah. And I liked him. That was my kind of guy. And I went home and I said to my wife, I said, I met the most awful person I've ever met in my life. He told me I was going to die if I don't do this stuff. And the next day I asked him to be my sponsor. Because he was the first person in my adult life who looked me in the eye, told me stuff I really didn't want to hear, and I knew he was telling the truth. And he's been my sponsor ever since. Now, that was in 1997, and I should theoretically be in my 14th year. But after a year and a half, see, my sponsor was one of those guys. He said, there's three things I want you to do. You want me to do three things? Okay, what? He says, well, number one, I want you to call me every day. I thought, well, that's kind of gay. What, why am I going to be... I'm going to be calling this guy every day, he said, so that you can be accountable. I thought, I can do that. Okay. Well, what's number two? And he says, I want you to get three commitments at meetings. Well, I'd been around for a couple of weeks. I knew what a commitment meant. It meant doing the dirty work. And I said, why three? I said, I've heard people who had to get one commitment, but isn't three a little severe? He says, how often did you get loaded? I said, every day. And he says, I think you should do seven commitments. We finally came to rest at four. I should have never questioned it. And then the third thing was, he says, I want you to work with a newcomer at every meeting. I said, you know something? I don't think you're listening. I'm a newcomer. I have 18 days. What do you want me to do? Work the steps with them? He says, why would you think that? You don't know anything about the steps. You know, just like you to jump ahead like that. He says, what you could do is you could tell them where the coffee is, or tell them what meeting you went to yesterday, or tell them how you got to sleep last night, if you did. I thought, okay, I'll work with newcomers. And he wasn't much of a step Nazi, as we come to call them. And he basically says, you know, yeah, go ahead and work the steps, which I don't find works in my sponsorship game. But because basically it's like having the crabs and somebody gives you the medicine for it, but you decide to wait a year to use it. You know, who suffers? I gave you the medicine. So I went home to do the steps. You know, I had seen them up on the, you know, the window shades on the wall, and went home, and I knew I was powerless over drugs and alcohol, so that one was easy. And in the big book, it says, you know, that we conceded to our innermost self that we were alcoholics. And I could actually do that. Concede means to admit reluctantly. It's not some joyous festive occasion. It's to admit reluctantly. And admit means to let in. It doesn't mean to announce or proclaim or, you know, tell the world. So I admit, I reluctantly had let into my innermost soul that I was an alcoholic. Step two had that higher power thing in it, and I was pretty sure I knew what they meant. I come from a family where my dad was an atheist, I think, and my mom was a pantheist, which means she thought God was everywhere, except in my dad. And there wasn't much prayer or meditation going on, so I had no idea what to do there, so I skipped step two. Step three, they come right out in the name of God, so I wasn't about to get involved in that. I did step four in my head, which of course meant that I didn't have to read it to anybody in step five. Six and seven, God, higher power again. So there I was, what, like 45 minutes into it, I'm on step eight. And since I hadn't done any of the work, I didn't have much of a list. And but I knew there was a couple people that I had outrightly stolen from, so I wrote them out a check and sealing it in the envelope and you know, putting the stamp on. I'm like an hour and 20 minutes into it, and I'm on step 10, ready to help other alcoholics. Unfortunately, in A Vision for You, it says you can't transmit something you haven't got. That's AA code for you will transmit what you do got. And what I had was absolute garbage, and that's what I was transmitting, and that's how I did my first year, but I stayed sober for a year that way. And then I broke my arm, and my sponsor met me at the hospital to make sure I didn't get a shot of anything fun. And at the end of it, the doctor gave me a big bottle of Vicodin, and I thought, jackpot, you know, because I knew that AA-approved medicine meant that it had my name on it, a doctor's name on it, and a dosage, and, you know, here was the bottle. It was a winner as far as I could see. And my sponsor said, I want you to call me before you take every single pill. And he said, and let me read that. It says, one pill every 6 hours, not six pills every 1 hour. You would do that. And I said, well, that means I'm probably going to be taking some late at night. He says, call me. If I don't answer the phone, leave me a message. So I called him before every single pill. And after about 3 weeks, I mean, I really liked sobriety. Sobriety had been good to me. And after about 3 weeks, I decided that I could get by just with ibuprofen. So I called him up and said, I don't think I need these things anymore. He says, great, flush them down the toilet. Well, somewhere in the back of my mind, which is where I've lived most of my adult life, there's an alcoholic, and whoop, penalty marker on the field, you don't flush narcotics down the toilet. I don't care who this guy thinks he is. So I took the phone over by the toilet, made a flushing sound, and we were pretty much done with that issue. Well, about a month later, I had one of those headaches that only a Vicodin seemed worthy of. And I looked at the bottle. It had my name on it, had a doctor's name on it, and I thought, well, that's AA approved. And I knew it wasn't. I knew I was being the same little manipulative con artist that I had been all my life, that it wasn't intended for that headache. It was given to me for a broken arm. It had nothing to do with that, and it was not AA approved. But somehow I was able to con myself into a state of denial where I took one of those pills, one little pill, thought, now what could that hurt? Well, as soon as I could be dishonest about one thing, I could be dishonest about anything and everything. I had excuses and alibis made up for things that hadn't even been asked of me yet. An hour later, I was drinking vodka out of an open bottle with the band I was producing. And then I had a great idea. I needed a line of coke. So I called a pager number I hadn't called for over a year. Figured it was probably disconnected. Like 45 seconds later, the phone rings. Richard, you're back. Good God, this, are you going broke without me or what? You know? And I said, I need a line of coke. So I ordered an ounce delivered. And he said, you know, the only problem is, he says, I've been selling you coke for 25 years, but I've always sold you powder, and all I have is rock. He said, rock, powder, what's the difference? Well, I found out what the difference was that night. Smoking crack's like having sex with a gorilla. It's not over until the gorilla says it's over. So there I was, headed for the bottom of the swamp, the crack pipe, and I was still going to meetings. I was still sponsoring guys. I was secretary of three meetings. You know, what's a guy to do? And it was real hard to be honest until my wife actually caught me in the act, and I ended up with a fishbowl full of those stupid newcomer chips, and it finally hit a point where about 4 months into that run, I was locked in a shed behind my recording studio, and I had taken one of those hits that was a little bit too big, and I'd knocked over my bottle of vodka as I fell to the floor in convulsions, and I had one of those benzomatic plumber's torches that I had lit to keep the pipe going at all times. And I knocked that over, and I thought, uh-oh, it's Richard Pryor time. I'm going to burn up in this little shed. They'll find me in 3 weeks, and this is not good. So it was like a Hail Mary pass. You know, you're in the last 2 seconds of the game. You're like 6 points behind, and you think maybe you could even up the score. And I said, God, please help me. I didn't even know what it meant. And at that moment, it was like a warm breeze blew into the room and picked me up off the floor. I think I did, in all honesty, steps 1, 2, and 3 with that one sentence. I knew I was powerless over drugs and alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of that power. I decided to do the steps the way they're actually done around here, and I got somebody to work with me who really works the steps. I did a written fourth step. Boy, that's a concept. And you know why we write the fourth step? It comes from the Oxford group, which is where the program came from, and they had a saying that the weakest ink is stronger than the strongest memory. And that's why we write it down. It was one of their common little sayings. And I read that fourth step to my sponsor, and my sponsor, not only was it a matter of confession, which is what I thought it was going to be, and I was going to realize that I wasn't as cool a person as I thought I was, but he said, you know, there's patterns that are running through your lives here. You're dishonest all the time. You're tardy all the time. You know, you're arrogant, and you're greedy, and all of these things that he pointed out that were the exact nature of my wrongs. And I understood at that point why we now read it to a sponsor rather than, you know, an Ethiopian cab driver or something. And then he set me off on steps 6 and 7. Well, he's still the same guy who said, go do the steps yourselves. And I did 6 and 7 as they're written in the big book, which is really a matter of two paragraphs, and at the end of which, after you do the seven-step prayer, it says, you've now completed step 7. Oh, yippee. That's the only place in the book where it gives you some kind of insight like that. And nothing happened. You know, I figured, you know, I'll turn this over to God, and God's going to fix my character defects, you know, and I'll go watch TV, you know. And by the way, there's a mortgage bill on the table, and the lawn needs mowing, and the dishes need washing. Thank you, God, and I'll be back after Law and Order. And you know, I get up, and mortgage is still on the table, the car's not washed, the dishes are still in the sink. You know, what's God doing for me? Well, I came to realize that God will do for me what I can't do for myself, but he won't do anything for me that I can do for myself. And what was required of me was to start practicing the opposites. Where I'd been dishonest, I had to start practicing being honest, if only one sentence at a time. And I'll tell you, the first time I told the truth on purpose in my adult life, it was a spiritual experience. And I kind of felt good about it, and it woke up something inside me of, oh, maybe there's something to this. The first time I was on time anywhere in my adult life, that was a spiritual experience. And I liked it. It felt good. I see why people are on time. You know, the first time I stopped being totally selfish and started having any concern for the welfare of another human being, what we call in the big book altruism, it was a spiritual experience, and it felt good, and I liked it. And it's starting to wake up this thing inside me. You know, Bobby talked about how, thank you, Bobby, about how, you know, the God thing, and, you know, it's just, you know. And it says in the big book, nobody need have trouble with the spirituality of the program. Yet, more than 50% of the people I talk to, that's their biggest problem in the whole thing. And somehow or another, we equate it with religion. And the spirituality is not like taking a class where at the end of it I get to, you know, 50 questions and, multiple choice. And if I get, you know, like more than 90% on it, I get an A in spirituality. The spirituality of the program is doing these little spiritual things. It says nobody need have trouble with the spirituality of the program. And then the next sentence says something to the effect of, God does not make too difficult terms to those who seek him. I wonder what that means. And then later on in We Agnostics, it says, deep down within every man, woman, and child lies the fundamental concept of a power greater than themselves. That was asleep inside me, waiting to do these little things, to tell the truth, to be on time, to stop being so judgmental, to stop being so arrogant, to have a little bit of empathy for other people, to have a little humility. All of those little spiritual things woke up that thing, and I found I do have a power greater than myself. It's living inside me, and it's awake now, and it's hungry. And it wants to do these things. It wants to be of service. It wants to take part and be a part of life. And that power has become what I now call God, the most important thing in my life. That's how 6 and 7 work. There's a book called Drop the Rock, and it's basically an analogy between somebody who's in the program who has a gigantic rock on a chain around their neck, and that's their character defects, and there's a boat leaving the dock, and the person's running for the boat, and they say, jump, swim, you can make it, you can make it, and the rock pulls them to the bottom, and they're saying, drop the rock, get rid of your character defects, you can make it, you can be here with us. And that's what happens as I started practicing the opposites of those things in my life. 8 and 9, 8 seems real easy, because basically all we think of is made a list, but the 8 is really the harder one, because it's and became willing to make amends to them all. There's no little excuse of except when to do so would injure them or the others. So by the time you're done with 8, you've already decided that you're willing to do this thing. In 9, we go out and we make eyeball-to-eyeball amends, and we get straight with the world. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when I was wrong, probably admitted it. Why is that funny? funny. It's funny because it's so ludicrous. We can't live that way. And that's what humor is. In steps 10 and 11, it tells us exactly how to pray. Praying only for God's will and the power to carry that out. And meditation, that really confused me, because I always thought meditation meant, you know, sitting in a lotus position with all the colored rocks around me and the candles burning and the incense and a mantra and all that kind of stuff. Well, back in 1935, I looked up in Webster's, meditation meant to say a prayer repeatedly with a goal of understanding. And that's why we have these prayers in AA that we use. Anyway, there I was on the floor, shaking like a fish, thinking I was going to die, and I said, God, please help me. And that power came into the room. And I thought about, gosh, is my life over? Do I never get to get loaded again? I thought that, you know, that I had been partying all this time, and that that was what I was, this great party animal. I looked up party in the dictionary. It's two or more people celebrating some event. And I'll tell you, by that time, I was one or less person locked in a shed. It wasn't going real well. Dr. Phil always says, and how's that working for you? Well, he only asks it when he knows that it's not going well. I have a real enthusiasm for this program, as you may have gathered. And, you know, it was such an honor not only to be the speaker, but to give cakes to four of my favorite people in the world at this meeting. And you know, this meeting has been so important to me. This was the first meeting I came to not loaded. And my life has changed. I have this enthusiasm. I looked up enthusiasm in the dictionary. It comes from the Greek, in, which means within, theos, which means God, and asm, which means the expression of. So it's the expression of the God within. And that's what we get in this program. I know the day that I said that, God, please help me, I was dying. And today I'm doing all kinds of shit you can't do if you're dead. And I know that it's a program of attraction rather than promotion, and I'm not sure if that's attraction or promotion, but it should work to sell the program to damn near anybody. I know it's a thin line between carrying the message and spreading the disease. I hope I've helped carry the message. Thank you. Yeah.